Before I give the introduction, John, why don't you go ahead and give us the pre-introduction? You got a case?
It's one I ran across there helping a guy this week, and it's a real short one, but, man, it carries a little punch. It says, a mere presumption that a thing was done cannot be used by the government or any other person to separate another from his or her private property. And that's a Supreme Court case, Cleveland Board of Education versus LaFleur at 414 U.S. 632, 1974 case. So,
can you give us some background?
Well, I was helping a guy with a tax court appeal, but an appellate appeal of a case where they came after him. But the thing they forgot to do was to ever send him a notice of deficiency. And I've got another Supreme Court case that says they can't take your stuff unless you've had a chance to go to tax court. So anyway, he's all the way up to the appellate level on a claim that the IRS made, and they never sent him a notice of deficiency. So their entire claim, what happens is the district court didn't have the jurisdiction to hear it since he'd never had the chance to go to tax court. So anyway, that's where we're shooting at. And I stumbled across this case, and I thought, well, that's a pretty handy one to have, because there's so many presumptions made by the courts and these lawyers and everything, prosecutors that start a case, but they start the case without the foundation. And they start the case on a presumption, okay? And this case says that the government can't make the presumption to take your property. Anyway,
Can you read the quote again after that one more time just to let it sink in?
Okay. A mere presumption that a thing was done cannot be used by the government or any other person to separate another from his or her private property. Cleveland Board of Education versus LaFleur, LaFleur, 414 U.S. 632, 1974 case.
Thank you for that, John. Well, everybody, I want to welcome you to the House of Prayer Call. This is the 10th day of February 2022, so they say. And if it's the first time on this call, I want to say welcome. We call it the hop call. When you get an email, you might see the hop call. We're not talking about the International House of Pancakes. It's the House of Prayer Call. And every call, I tell you my mission statement that I've endeavored in my life to take and make dear to me. And that's Isaiah 58:6. Which is the chosen fast, Isaiah 58:6, to loose the band of wickedness, to undo the heavy burden, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Now, I know that I won't be able to break every yoke, but I want to be part of the team that's endeavoring to break every yoke. And if you are on these calls tonight and it's your first time, I want you to be aware that we don't do them every Thursday. We give ourselves a break, and we do it every other Thursday. Sometimes it turns out to be two, maybe sometimes three times a month, on every Thursday night. Our next call is scheduled for the 24th of February 2022, so they say. So tonight's topic is part one of Guru Magnetism. Now, I'm going to be very careful tonight to obey Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. Now, some of you that have been tracking with these calls for a couple of years now realize that I bring people on these calls, and we examine what they say. We give them our ear, and we ask them to approve and to bring proof that what they say is so. And we're pretty much not prejudicing anybody from speaking their mind, what they feel, what they think they've seen, what they saw. These things are important to us as we're endeavoring to seek our freedom in what appears to be a system which has become adversarial to us. Now, whether it has or whether it has not yet remains to be seen. And when you get done with this call tonight, you might have a different opinion about some of these things that are said. I'm always off on this is that disease. I did this and that happened, therefore this is that. Or I didn't do this and that happened, and therefore this is that. These are incomplete reasoning. It's you have no idea, unless you practice a scientific method, that if you do this the same way that he did this, that will happen. And even then, even if you do the exact same way, you're not guaranteed or assured in this life that you're going to get the same results. Now, there are a few exceptions to that, what we call natural laws of God. For example, if you put vinegar, true 5% acidic vinegar, into Arm & Hammer baking soda, you're going to have a reaction. That's a law of physics. And when we're dealing with the courts, the lawyers, the judges, the machinery of courts, and what have you, there are so many gray areas and so many variables in there that it's oftentimes difficult to get a scientific method about any process or procedure. Now, the exception to that is the rules of court. And if you were on our last call, you remember we did a lot of discussion about knowing the rules, why the rules are there, that the Supreme Court created rules to create equity amongst plaintiffs and defendants as far as what is fair in regards to a controversy that comes within their court. The rules are there for a reason. But I'm going to be real careful tonight, so I'm not going to mention any names of any of these gurus that people gravitate towards, and I'm going to do it for a reason. The same way as when I come on these calls, I've been at this since, I say at this, I've been at Endeavoring Isaiah 58:6 for myself and my neighbors for, well, since 1989. Traveled 29 years without a driver's license, in my possession, behind the wheel, with my family and my 9 offspring. We traveled, and I did my best at the time with the knowledge I had to live a life in the private. Now, in that time, I made mistakes. I followed wrong advice. I did things that were potentially dangerous to my life and liberty. And I would say that I've got a pretty good grasp on why people do the things they do. We're going to talk about that a little later in the call. But what I'm being real careful about tonight, and the reason why I'm not mentioning names, and the reason why I'm real careful to let everybody speak, even though I may not agree with everything that they say, and I just want to put that disclaimer up here for anyone that comes on this call, because I got shooed out a few calls back saying that my guest speaker insulted every American. So just so you have this disclaimer, I hold no responsibility for the words that come out any of the special guests, participants, and members of the House of Prayer, wherever they are. I'm not responsible for the words that they say. I don't necessarily agree with every word of every guest or of every participant, and nor should you. Just because it's on the House of Prayer call, say it's got to be true. That would be a dangerous place to be. I'm encouraging everybody to do their own research and be thoroughly convinced about a matter before they act upon it or take any or potentially put themselves in any harm's way from following through with anything they hear on this call, or for that matter, anywhere else on the internet or elsewhere. And I do this carefully in conformity to Philippians chapter 2, verse 3. And as you know, this is a spiritual call. We gather under our ecclesiastical right to gather and help and bear ye one another's burdens and fulfill the law of Christ in doing that. As we know that there are devils in this world, and a lot of those devils are down at your courthouse wearing suits, and you would never believe by looking at them they're the devils that they are. And they cause strife, and they raise bigotry, and they cause the breakup of families and the destruction of equity. And they steal, kill, rob, and destroy. And Jesus was, therefore, in keeping with our day and age, when he told them then, woe to you lawyers. There's nothing has really changed as far as the troubles and where they originate in our world. But the scripture tells us in Philippians 2:3, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. So on these calls, I do my very best to give everybody an ear. Your experiences are valued. In lowliness of mind, I want to esteem you better than myself and to lift you up and give you the ability to share and speak. And that's what I do with my guests, and I do that with my very best to everybody that calls in and has a question. With that in mind, would you please hold all your questions or comments until I open the floor for that? And once again, I'm going to remind you to please mute out your phone so that we have no background noise until you're asking a question, so I don't have to work the board here as a moderator. So part two of this, on the second part of my guru magnetism call, will be on the 24th. So stay tuned for that in 2 weeks. So I want to start with a little commentary on why people get attracted to and thereafter follow gurus. You know, some of the reason is it's a little difficult, or maybe it's rather difficult for you, depending on your ability to read and write and what have you, to wade through the rules of evidence, or for that matter, the rules of civil or criminal procedure. It's much easier to try and find a fast track out of your issue and then following through with learning the law, learning how to manage your own case. If you have a lawyer, learning how to put them on a leash, learning why you may not want a lawyer. A lot of that has been brought out on these calls. One of the things about a lawyer that we learned from a case that I think it was both Ed and John, and they'll have a chance to correct me. And please, if you're hearing this and you know the case, please have it ready to share with the members that are on this call tonight so that we can have a complete, because I don't remember the exact case, but the case is basically that when you have a lawyer, you cannot challenge a jurisdiction of the courts, and at the courts, the lawyer actually admits to the jurisdiction, and you lose your right to challenge the jurisdiction by the mere fact that you have an attorney. And so that's the Supreme Court case we've learned on this call. My sieve of a brain has lost it right now, and I can't put my finger on it. And I hope that one of you that has it will be able to share it with the group either now or when the time comes. Hearing none, I'm going to move on. I'm going to read you a passage from the scripture, as every once in a while we do that here, and I hope the Bible doesn't offend you. If it does, you're more free to hang up right now, and I'm certainly not wishing to offend anybody, but we do talk the Bible every now and then on this Ecclesiastical House of Prayer call, and I'm doing this for a purpose. This is a really interesting passage out of 1 Kings, I believe it's 3. I've lost the reference, but I'm going to read it from the Bible right now. And give me a second, I'll tell you where the reference is. And maybe I won't real fast. If somebody can find it while I'm talking, I think it's 1 Kings chapter 3.
How do I get this on mute?
Star 6.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Star 6 for anybody. All right, so I believe it's 1 Kings 3, and there came a man of God, it might be 13 for that matter, there came a man of God out of Judah by the word of the Lord to Bethel, and Jeroboam, or Jehovah, how you want to pronounce that, some of you like to pronounce things more with a Hebrew-sounding voice, and you're probably much better at it than me. He stood by the altar, Jeroboam is what I used to call him as I read it all the time, he stood by the altar to burn incense, and he cried against the altar, in the word of the Lord, and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, the child shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and upon you shall he offer the priests of the high places that burn incense upon you, and men's bones shall be burnt upon you. Of course, that's a little bit opposed to the word of the Lord, if you would, of the Torah, but let's keep going. And he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign which the Lord hath spoken. Behold, the altar shall be rent, and ashes that are upon it shall be poured out. And it came to pass, when King Jeroboam heard the saying of the man of God, which he had cried against the altar in Bethel, that he put his hand forth from the altar, saying, lay hold on him. And his hand, which he put forth against him, dried up, so that he could not pull it in again to him. The altar also was torn, rent, and the ashes poured out from the altar according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. That's pretty cool, huh? You say something and all of a sudden, kabam, it happens. It sounds like it's right out of Saturday morning cartoons. And the king answered and said to the man of God, and don't take that offensively. I'm just saying this is something that you don't see every day. And the king answered and said unto the man of God, entreat now the face of the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored me again. And the man of God besought the Lord, a term meaning prayed, and the king's hand was restored him again and became as it was before. Bada bing, bada bong. And the king said unto the man of God, come home with me and refresh yourself, and I'll give you a reward. And the man of God said to the king, if you'll give me half your house, I will not go with you. Neither will I eat bread nor drink water in this place. So he went another way, and he returned not by the way that he came to Bethel. Now there dwelt an old prophet in Bethel, and his sons came and told him all the works that the man of God had done that day in Bethel, and the word which he spoke to the king. They also told that to their father. And their father, which is an old man and his old prophet in Bethel, said, which way did he go? For his sons had seen what way the man of God went when he came from Judah. And he said to his sons, saddle me the ass. So they saddled him the ass, and he rode thereon. And he went after the man of God and found him sitting under an oak. And he said to him, are you the man of God that came from Judah? And he said, I am. He said to him, come home with me and eat bread. Now, a little backstory here. This is the man that had just performed that work. The altar was rent, the king's hand was withered, and the king's hand was restored. And this old man, this old prophet, heard about him, got some information, got some of the intel from his sons, and he went after him, and he found him sitting under this oak tree, as the story goes. He said, come home to me and eat bread. And this man said, I'll not return with you nor go in with you, neither will I eat bread nor drink water with you in this place. For it was said to me by the word of the Lord, you shall eat no bread nor drink water there, nor turn again to go by the way that you came. But then the old man said, I'm a prophet also, as you are. And an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, bring him back with you into your house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied unto him. So he went back with him and did eat his bread in his house, and he drank water. And it came to pass as they sat at the table that the word of the Lord came to the prophet that brought him back. The prophet that brought the man back that lied to him said to the man of God that came from Judah, thus says the Lord, for as much as you have disobeyed the mouth of the Lord and have not kept the commandment which the Lord the God had commanded you, but you came back and eaten bread and drank water in the place of which the Lord did say to you, eat no bread and drink no water, your carcass shall not come into the sepulcher of your fathers. And it came to pass, after he had eaten bread and after he had drunk, he saddled for him the ass, to wit for the prophet whom he had brought back. And when he was gone, a lion met him by the way and slew him, and his carcass was cast in the way, and the ass stood by it. The lion also stood by the carcass. And behold, men passed by and saw the carcass cast in the way, and the lion standing by the carcass, and they came and told it to the city where the old prophet dwelt. And when the prophet that brought him back from the way heard thereof, he said, it is the man of God who is disobedient unto the word of the Lord. Therefore the Lord has delivered him unto the lion, which has torn him and slain him, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke to him. And he spoke to his son, saying, saddle me an ass. And they saddled him, and he went and found his carcass in the way, and the ass and the lion standing by the carcass. And the lion had not eaten the carcass, nor tore the ass. And the prophet took up the carcass of the man of God, laid it upon the ass, and brought it back. And the old prophet came to the city to mourn and to bury him. And he laid his carcass in his own grave, and they mourned over him, saying, alas, my brother. I don't know if any of you have ever heard that story before from the scriptures, but I've remembered it from a long time. And the reason I share it with you today is because here's a man that knew it to do good and did it not. And like Romans says, he that knows to do good and does it not, to him it's error. Here's a man that was given instructions. Now, whether or not this is a story, a parable, or a real incident, I have no relevance, nor do I care to argue about that. It serves as an example for us to give us instructions in the way that we should walk. Some things are meant to be avoided. Let's talk about them. So our topic is magnetism, guru magnetism. And what can we learn from the scriptures about guru magnetism? Well, for example, Jesus told us to call no man father. He also said, whoever is great among you shall become your servant. He said the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship, but it shall not be so among you. Paul came on the scene and told us, whatsoever things are just, lovely, and of good report, think on these things, and the peace of God will keep you. What does that mean? In the Old Testament, the prophet said, he has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Those are three principles, and justly and humbly, we've already talked about today, being humble, not being haughty, and esteeming each other better than ourselves. And let's talk about this thing about just. What does the scripture say about just? How about an unjust weight and balance is an abomination to the Lord? Have you heard that in the scriptures? So the question I would have to ask you, if we're talking about thinking about those things that are just and to doing those things that are just, is it okay for God's children to participate in unjust weights and measures because everyone else is? Can you avoid the penalties and punishments of having a lion eat up your carcass, this being disobedient to the ways of God because others are doing it? Can you avoid the punishment of being reaping what you sow because everyone else is participating in unjust weights and measures? I think not. And I'm going to encourage you that your eternal salvation, of course, and your eternity is as important or more important in this case, might argue, than what happens in here and now, even though that's all I know is the now. But we all do things knowing that we shall give an account of our lives. So that's talking about just, whatsoever things are just. Lovely self-explanatory. Some people would say, well, getting something for nothing is lovely to me. Well, it may be lovely, but is it just? And is it a good report? Well, I'm going to talk about a good report. Because whether or not it's just, the scripture has a lot to say about inequitable practices of receiving fast increase where you didn't have to lay anything out, getting a crop where you didn't have to plant, that which is obtained speedily. A lot of scriptures that people like to think about, and you can do your own studies, about gambling and receiving monies for nothing and how it slips through your fingers like sand. There's a lot about that in the scriptures. What about good reports? And do we listen to the scripture that says, at a mouth of two or three witnesses, let every word be established? I'm relating this to guru magnetism because just about any day in any month, a new guru will pop up on the scene, and he's got the floor. Of course, this happens until he's captured and put away by the Department of Justice, like so many gurus in the past, for this reason or that reason. Many of them could have been avoided, and some of them may, in fact, I'll admit, be railroad jobs. But oftentimes, much of what we consider a railroad job is our inexperience and lack of knowledge of what the law and jurisprudence around us is actually saying and how it actually acts. So we're going to construe it, he was railroaded. Why? Because you didn't know the rule of evidence. You didn't know when to object and what to object and what the objections were. Because you didn't know how to operate according to the rules of civil procedure in a civil proceeding, that means you were railroaded. and you didn't know what the prosecution could and could not do, and you didn't know the elements of the crime that they were required to prove against you, you didn't know when to object, you didn't know whether or not you were supposed to have a jury trial or a bench trial and weigh out which one would be better, and consider that perhaps on a jury trial, when you were dealing with matters of law where there's an appeal possible, you may want to avoid a jury trial if you want to make appeal, because a jury is unappealable unless there was something within the due process on getting to the jury, some defect in the trial proceeding that would be substance for a trial de novo, you're screwed. Pardon my language. So good report has to do with the testimony of two or three witnesses. Do we have a good report about this particular process this guru is sharing with us? He may be all fired up about it. He may say, I heard somebody did it. Now, what if he did it? I mean, some of you remember some of these gurus that were years ago. I'm not going to mention names. I told you in the beginning of the call, I want to avoid mentioning names. This is not a slam your favorite guru call. This is just a warning call and talking about guru magnetism. But I've been at this quite some time, and I've watched a guru show up, like, say, for example, in the year 2000. Back then, I was operating the common law courts, did the cancellature process, knew about what a U.S. citizen is, what it wasn't, studying two stat 153, putting in my paperwork on regards to it, and I was on my way and running. There were things that others that were doing at the time that I chose not to. It didn't match the good report. It wasn't just. I've heard these stories throughout the years. It didn't make any sense in law. I'll give you some examples so I don't leave you in the dark. I've never practiced copyright in my name. I've never attempted to get something when I have no energy in it and attempted to use government forms, that which the forms, when you read the instructions, clearly state this is for U.S. citizens. So I attempt to have it one way when I'm trying to fight the government, say I'm not a U.S. citizen, and then I'm double-minded, and a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. When I'm trying to get something for nothing, I'll admit to being a U.S. citizen because, after all, I'm going to get my bass boat. It doesn't work for me. I've avoided all of those things, knowing that the money system is the apple of their eye. When I looked at and realized the first act the United States created was an act to produce revenue for the District of Columbia, and nothing has changed the way the money is flowing. The river started. It was a small trickle in a stream back then. It's become a raging, flowing river, but it's all going one direction. And I've got news for you. It's this man's opinion and many others on this call. That's not into your pocket. Even as much as that might be desirable for you, that's not the way it is. It's not the way it was set up. The corporation didn't create rules to help you get wealthy. I know that's kind of difficult to believe because there's many gurus out there that they find a new group of people to follow them. Some are selling the programs. Many are offering them for free. Oftentimes when they offer them for free, more people follow suit because they can afford it. And number two, they think that that makes the man more honorable. A couple things that I have a problem with that. Oftentimes these men, we don't know the reasons why they're walking around doing the things they do. I'll give you, for example, one of my friends, she's not on the call tonight, she participated and spent a lot of time learning a process using the 1099 original issue discount. Now, we might have some people here that have been listening to gurus that think they know a lot about that subject. And if you do, you can instruct us and tell us your just weight and balance, your good report, and you can correct me and share what I'm wrong. I'll humbly admit it. But this is what I observed in her process. She didn't even touch the paperwork. She had a public accountant doing the work for her. She got a 7-year prison sentence for the original issue discount. There's a blanket conspiring to defraud the United States, very broad brushstroke federal statute that was used against her, and she never even touched the paperwork. She got out in 3.5 years because there was some program whereby she could get half time that was set in place for prisoners that because there was no victim involved, and she got out in 3.5 years. But these are the stories that I've heard following processes and programs. On the one hand, they want to admit they're not a U.S. citizen, and they'll fight tooth and nail to deny that status. But on the other hand, they'll fill out forms. The prerequisite for the form is that you must be a U.S. citizen. To me, it's a double-minded man. How do you see it? You have a chance to say when I open up the call for comments. So be very careful to recognize that these words about let at the mouth of 2-3 witnesses, letting every word be established, helps us not to fall on our face in the doo-doo. If we can research it out and see, has this got any track record with normal souls like you and I? And then, and even then, that does not make it so. Let me share with you something I've told a few of the people on this call, that through the years, this is an impression. This is not a dyed-in-the-wool. This is an impression that I've got. I will be honest with you. I've never had a chance to speak to the Department of Justice prosecutor and have him confess this to me in my ears in the private so I can tell it to you on the mountain. This is merely my impression. With that disclaimer, I'm going to share with you, it is my opinion and impression that oftentimes the DOJ or the local prosecuting attorney will let a well-known guru slip through the cracks, get his process out there, because they know there are 20, 30, 50 dumbasses to follow such unproven, unreliable, sovereign citizen BS, just like he did, if they let him go, so they can snarf him in later. So I will let, this is a public call in the sense that it's a private call between us, but it's out and anybody could join, and I don't know who you are. So if you're thinking that you're going to taunt and tempt me to do something that would be in a conspire to defraud the United States by operating with some form of monetary instrument against the laws and the customs of the United States, you're going to have to try harder. I'm not biting the bait. So I'm personally not doing it. And as a result of that, I'm very thankful to my Creator for the wisdom he gave me not to do those things. I personally have not spent the inside with a bunch of smelly men behind bars for attempting to grab of the money system in the United States, claiming it for my own. Now, before I go to an open discussion, I'm just going to lay the groundwork for next week's call. Next week's call, I'm going to get in specific, without mentioning names, I'm going to get specific about certain things certain gurus are saying, and that's, of course, God giving me, that's not week, it's 2 weeks from now, God giving me the grace to be able to prepare properly with this project to make sure that I get quotations of things that are actually said out of the mouth of gurus. I have a few of them for you tonight so you can get a flavor of what I'm talking about. Here is one guru, and here are some quotes out of this guru's mouth. So he's talking about putting paperwork in, and he's talking about creating liens against public service. And he's claiming that they're going to contractually agree that the things you put in print are the facts. This is the exact quote. They're going to contractually agree they are facts. So put whatever you want. Lie. Okay? Now that's an exact quote. No missing words. Here's a man purporting to be a guru instructing you to lie in print because, after all, they're going to contractually agree with you that they are facts. First of all, this man apparently has never studied contract law and to know what an agreement of the parties actually means. And he's never studied perhaps the one publication that many of you at least should look at is the Anti-Government Movement Handbook. Now, I know that the guys that put it together are definitely not a friend of liberty, and they certainly like to paint the bad picture on anybody that would stand up for the rights. However, the information that they put in that book should help you get an understanding of why some of our fellow members, freedom-loving people, have spent quality time that they could be spending with their families with a bunch of sweaty men behind bars. And this is some of the reasons. It's a misconception and a misunderstanding of basic law and contract law. Here's another thing that I'm putting on here that, let me see here. Hold on one second. Okay, another quote, this local, he's the guru of the day, the flavor of the day. If you want to lie, go ahead and lie, because they're going to agree to it anyway. Kind of puts an interesting twist on it when, in order to get a remedy in God's kingdom, you're forced to go ahead and lie anyway, because they're, in his opinion, they're going to agree to it anyway. This is all spoken with no concern for using the United States mail to send lies. What are lies sent through the mail? Can anybody help me real quick? What is it called if you send a lie through the mail that could influence somebody to act upon it? Anybody got any help out there?
Fraud.
What is it?
Fraud.
Yes. Fraud. Title 18, 1341, frauds and swindles. So I'm going to have a complete, I'm going to have some fun next in 2 weeks. I'm going to open it up. I'm going to bring a bunch of quotes from a bunch of different gurus. Like I said, not naming names. It's your job to do your diligence. It's really your job not to have gurus. That's my first encouragement to you. You want to have a guru look in the mirror and say, I am my own guru. It's my job to learn the law. It's my job to know whether these things are so. It's my job to be complete and perfect in all of my ways and be diligent to study whether things are so. I cannot endeavor to give that responsibility to any other man. Not Daniel, not David, not Ed, not John, not any other guru. I need to do my own diligence. So that's about my 45-minute or 40-minute rant and beginning of this call as a commentary on guru magnetism, in which I'd like to open up the call right now. There might be some of you that want to make comments or questions. Don't all speak at once, but please let's have a discussion on this Thursday night House of Prayer call about guru magnetism. Well, I'll just yield and take a break and get a drink of water. Anybody out there? It's going to be a short call, David.
Oh, I thought you were still getting the water.
Oh, I just get a drink of water while you guys go ahead and comment.
Oh, okay. I just want to briefly comment that your whole spiel about what is going on, what has been going on, is one of the reasons why I called my group the non-guru network, for the basic reasons that you have supremely articulated. And it is a big problem, and there are a lot of what you would call Trojan horses amongst us. So you really, 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 really have to rely on the Lord so you don't be led astray, because many people are. And I haven't survived 34 years in this battlefield and not getting caught up. It is because I intentionally try to stay humble, knowing that whatever that has been given to me in way of knowledge is not of myself, but what the Lord allowed for me to acquire. And as the words say, if any man glory, let him glory in the Lord. So one of the primary things that I see that is wrong amongst many of the so-called gurus is false pride. So if you can get false pride out of the way, you can see clearer. And many of these guys are blinded by pride. And I've confronted quite a few of them to the face to face, in the physical. And they're not able to stand on the words that they give the sheep. I did a seminar down in Texas, and there was a guy I worked with actually for a couple years. And I saw him going astray, giving out wrong information. Clearly, I was able to show and prove. And I don't like to do this, but I put the guy on the spot in front of a room full of people. And I divorced all ties after that. So I'm on board with you with the spirit in which you are presenting your concerns with. I'm 100% on board. With that,
yeah, thank you, Harold.
I stand down.
I know I want you to, if you feel liberty to, I would wish you to, I should say, we want for nothing. I would wish that you would share not the guru's name, but the subject matter if you feel so inclined, because it would be very relevant to for us to understand. An example, if you feel inclined.
Okay, the guy was presenting, I guess you would call it a novel approach with regards to using equity in the federal court. And some of the processes that he was trying to employ clearly are against the rules. The federal court is stringently controlled by rules. It almost has less latitude than you do on the state. But at the same time, you know, for those that they call pro se litigants, they give a little leeway. But what he was doing was going way overboard, employing equity principles as if they were part of statute. And you know that exclusive equity and the statutory realm don't mix. Now, Roman civil law equity and the statutes, you can do something with that, but not with exclusive equity. And he was trying to employ exclusive equity in the rules when it was clear, I believe it was 1948, when they combined the court with the under one umbrella in federal court, and a lot of state courts followed. So it was in stark conflict with the rules. And I was able to show and prove through the rules and that his novel approach would not work. And this is what I don't like also, is people that advocate processes, either one, not doing it themselves, or number two, don't have clients or friends that they did it for. So it could be direct or indirect. And I've done it both ways myself. Most of anything that I advance, I've done for myself or done for others. So there's a record to confirm what I am articulating. He was not able to do that. And I thought it was wrong that you're charging people all this money for a theory that has never been used. That was the crux of my objection. And at that same time, this was before, what is the guy that recently passed, well-known in the community?
Jack Smith?
Jack Smith. He was there in audience because I knew him also personally. And I have stories about Jack Smith, too, that I had to get on him. But it was privately. But Jack Smith was in the room when I did this to this person. And he's a friend of Jack Smith, and Jack Smith could not back him up. You don't play around with people's lives like that. And the Lord tells us to whom much is given, much is required. So if I stayed silent witnessing this and allow people to go astray based on something that has not been proven, has not been done, and is clearly against the rules, it would have been on my head. So, yes. And our relationship deteriorated right from there. I'm quick to move away from a false prophet. Once he's exposed, I'm out of there. And believe me, it doesn't happen on multiple occasions.
Well, we're told to mark those which walk unruly and avoid them. Where do we get our determination of what is ruly and what is unruly? What's our standard?
If five the word of God itself.
It has to be. If five people did it and got away with it, that might fulfill one of the tests that it might be of good report. Maybe. And I say that very carefully. Maybe. Five people may have gotten away with it because they're looking for a grand harvest of 25 or 50 or better yet 500 dumb sheep to shear and put in cages for their bonds. So just because five people didn't got away with it is not the three-part test that we talked about of just lovely and good report. We have a three-prong test. Is it just? If you don't have a moral compass of what is just and unjust, you're certainly to be led astray by every wind of teaching that comes your way, and you may find you're in a house with bedfellows that you may not appreciate, and you had no choice with your roommates. That's just a warning.
There was a going back to what you were speaking on the 1099 OIDs, and this is back, I think, around 2012 to around 2015. It was like off the charts. Everybody was doing it. And they asked me. I said, call me back after 3 years, and then I'll let you know. Because, you know,
right,
on the federal side, they have 3 years to wait. And those 3 years went by, and then all of a sudden there was a huge sweep across the country. And many of them went into the country club with gates. And some of the people I know very personally. And one guy, I even told him, don't just jump on anything. And it's very similar to the story that you told about the young lady. He didn't even do it. He just went to a seminar. Everybody in the seminar was rounded up. They didn't even get a chance to start. But it was going to the seminar. They presumed it to be intent to defraud.
And the thing I want to share about this, too, is, here's another principle. Thank you, Harold, because you stirred something up that I wanted to say earlier, and that is count the cost. If you're prepared and could care less about your roommates and you don't mind being fed slop that somebody peed in or spit in a prison population, and if that doesn't bother you to be ripped away from your freedom and your liberty, and if that's not on the table for you to think about, then carry on and don't even pay attention to what we said. If your liberty is not important to you as one of the most important and precious gifts as well as rights, then just don't pay attention. But if you have an understanding that Jesus spoke about this, that no man builds a house unless he considers ahead whether he has the materials. No king goes to war unless he considers how many men he has to fight. You're going to have to weigh in the balance. You're going to have to look at, if I do A and B happens, am I willing to risk what it is that B is if I do A? If you're not thinking about that, I'm not saying operate out of fear. I said Just look at the raging water. Look which way it's flowing before you jump in. All right, I'm sorry for that little rant, Harold. You just stirred me up. Would you have any more to say? Because, I mean, you were doing really good.
Yeah, one more thing, and I have to step away for a few moments. I'll be back. But the other thing was that the fervor was so great of what people were doing and what they were trying to do. Even when you try to warn them, they still wanted to try because they saw other people getting the so-called money. That I created a clause to show that they were operating in good faith based on the information that they had and that there was no intent to interfere with commerce or to defraud the government. Those that used those clauses literally got around persecution or prosecution. Because once you express the intent, then they have to prove that your intent was not as stated. But those that did not use it got prosecuted.
Yeah, thanks for that again. Another great reminder of what I wanted to share. I have agreed with you. I've done the same thing, Harold. I call it a disclaimer. You call it a clause. Basically, what I have shared with people is if you're going to touch the apple of their eye, you better have it clear and concise. I like using the words void or prohibited by law. It's the name of a book I've been working on for about 10 years, and when it comes out, I'm going to be so excited. I might be not old enough to read it by the time I get it out there because I won't be able to see the page, you know, see the writing anymore. I should say young enough to read it. But that's the disclaimer is it goes to intent. And it goes to if there's any part of this document, of these instruments, that is unlawful, then these are declared void from the beginning. Ab initio, it's not my intent to violate any law that which can this can be construed as in violation of. You know, make it very crystal clear on the paper that it's not your intent to violate a law, because as we are that are in this movement understand, as Harold just brought out, and I'm so thankful you did, they've got to prove intent that you knowingly and willfully did such. When you have a disclaimer on the instrument, and that instrument is part of the record of the very thing that they might be claiming is fraud or forgery or intent to influence a government official, which, by the way, that's a serious one. Guys, leave the judges and the prosecuting attorneys alone. Learn the law and bind them with their own words and bind them to their oaths and follow the rules of procedure, which they won't do because they know that you are following these gurus and not learning the things that you need to learn. I'm going to put a little commercial in here that if you've never had any experience, on my webpage, there's on the email 2 weeks ago, and I didn't put it on this week, there's a link for you can go and you can acquire the jurisdictionary course. Now, it's not perfect. It's written by a lawyer, but it's wonderful if you never had any background. And I personally don't know any way to tell you it's wrong, but it is the way the legal system works. Get an education. Understand why your emotion's not being heard. Understand why your disqualifications aren't working. Instead of pointing the finger at them, start with pointing it at yourself. And it could be, I mean, it really could be that the reason why you were railroaded is because you laid the track.
That is so, so true. So, so true. By the way, you should be able to get him. I've had several conversations with Dr. Graves, and he's very willing to go on other people's platform. And, he would be a perfect guest for you to get up here.
As a matter of
because
fact,
I believe what fact, he does. What's that again?
I'm saying, as a matter of fact, he has agreed to come on our call. David and I spoke to him a few weeks back.
Okay, great.
He was busy with family, and he's waiting for our call. We've had a very high-profile case that we've been working with that went to jury trial. We've been derailed from a lot of the things that we wanted to do, but he will be a guest speaker on our call. And that's something to look forward to. But that's a good commercial because we've already spoken to Frederick Graves. He likes to be called Dr. Graves.
Yeah, Dr. Graves. Yeah, I have, but I will warn you, and this is based on my interactions with him, a lot of the things that are on the private side, he is not a fan of. So as long as you keep it within, you know, the Roman civil legal platform, he's good. But what I really push his program for is because he shows us in very simplistic terms on the eighth grade level that it's all about the rules and procedures and evidence and how to properly present it to the course. It's an excellent course. Excellent. I've been dealing with him for years, and I've put up his links whenever I can. And for people that are serious about this, even if it doesn't per se apply always to the private side, but the principles and the rules are very similar, and it would be edifying education for everyone to have this. I've been had the jurisdictionary course when they were on CDs, and this is
That's how I got them, Harold. I've been through mine. It's the little CDs. It's exactly how I have mine.
Yeah. And when he went over to online, I got on online, and here I've been in 34 years, and I still see value in that program to this day. I often go back to refresh.
And so I know for a fact that as a result of putting out our calls, we know that one party listened to these calls and has acquired the jurisdictionary course. So one party that's on these calls will be smarter, and I don't know who that is, and I may not want to know. You don't have to demonstrate who you are, but I know that there wasn't a rush to learn. So now that you have two witnesses, that's Harold and myself, and I know David was on it too, that's three witnesses, I'm encouraging you again, if you are taking on a matter and you don't, and you have to manage your case and you're in a civil dispute, or if you're in a court case already and you don't know about the law, within 24 hours, literally, that's how he writes it, within 24 hours, you can learn how to win your own case. That is fact. Because you'll learn what many lawyers are lazy about the rules, because the people that they're coming against don't know what they are.
That is so true. I catch DAs, prosecuting attorneys out there all the time on the rules. And that's something that you can hold them hard and fast to. You know, they can get slippery with the facts or anything. But in this system, remember, form supersedes substance. So if they hold you to form, you can hold them to form. And I've been very successful that way, because a lot of times, if you can't get them on their errors, procedural errors, a lot of times you're not going to win. Because once you get past a certain point, it's basically their ball game, especially if you're playing defense. Now, if you're playing offense, that's a different story. But when you're playing defense, it's all about the rules, regulations, policies, and procedures. And they generally, and in my experience, I would say 99% of the time, they're not in the ball game. But just like you said, they predicate it on the fact that you don't know.
Lawyers have a good reason to be lazy. They don't have an opponent there that's worthy. The prosecuting attorney's got a 98% success rate because everybody's going and giving their money to attorneys that don't have a chance against a 98% success rate and criminal charges. What is it, the Rehnquist said 100% of people that are in jail are there voluntarily?
Well,
I'm having a hard time speaking. So,
and that's from a Supreme Court justice.
Right. So my encouragement is, again, we should have a half a dozen people or a dozen people taking the course from this call. It's not that expensive. It's under $300. If you click the link, a small perk will be sent to David and I. It'll definitely benefit the House of Prayer, because that's the program that Frederick Graves put in place for us. And that's the commercial, though. We're kind of jealous for you to learn, because that would help you manage your case, and that'd take ease the load of people that are calling us and saying, "Hey, do you know how to? We should do this." And you know, we're not attorneys. We don't have fish stocking workers there running into the doing our bidding as our legal team doing our reading of the law and what do you call that, paralegal work. It's just not happening. We don't have a law firm. So people call, and they call John, or they call Ed, or they call me, or they call David. We're just one people. If you all learn those things, it'll benefit everybody that you come in contact with, including yourself and this call. Learn the rules. All right. I think I harped on that enough. That was a pretty decent commercial. Thank you for that, Harold. So
Daniel, that was totally unintended, but I'm glad to help.
I got somebody else calling in. Who was that, David?
Yeah.
Well, I – okay.
Sorry, I just wanted to say that, you know, yes, there's tons of gurus out there. There's all kinds of information that's available on the Internet. What isn't there is a magic pill. Anybody that's been doing this for any length of time, there is no magic pill. Gurus are going to tell you, this is the process, the end all processes. Give me your money. Take your pill. You know, and they get a lot of people that way. It really is up to you. Nobody, the guru's not going to go into court with you. The guru's not going to take your punishment for following their process. But it really does come down to you. Daniel said it earlier. Don't believe a single word that any of us say. Go and look it up for yourself, because it's not going to, you know, the truth that we know isn't going to set you free. The truth that you know will set you free, and you have to know it yourself. If I give you a piece of, if I give you a document, and I, you know, that I spent time researching and preparing, and you don't make it your own, if you don't know it, if you don't even look it over, and you just go stick it in thinking it's going to be a magic bullet, this system doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. There is no magic pill to learning procedure, rules of evidence, you know, the rules of the game. And Harold said it, and Daniel said it, that you can, you know, they don't have any competition. Nobody's going in there and holding them accountable, objecting, you know, understanding the workings of the machine. The machine isn't corrupt. It's the people that work the machine that are corrupt. And unless you can see that yourself and know where they're, you know, where they're cheating, you know, where they're cheating the rules, you know, they can continue doing it.
I call bullshit.
I object. On what grounds? Oh, Santa Monica? That's a joke, guys. Yeah. On what grounds? Oh, we had somebody else that was trying to jump in there. It was a lady's voice.
Yeah.
Me. That was me. So, do you want me to say my name?
Who's me?
Right. You could do whatever you want.
To share. Or whatever you like to be called by.
I know some people get after me if I claim my name in front of you all.
But, well, you can claim a name. See, like they call, I call myself Sovereign Man from Freedom Land. How you like that?
Hey, I'm allowed to have copyright and patents and intellectual property, and I'm allowed to accept the gifts my mother and father gave me. That's how I look
at
it.
How's that working for you?
So, it's actually going very well.
Great.
What?
I got two people talking, and I'm a little bit confused. Is there? Are you all know each other and have come to the call? Because I'm not sure. I've got someone from 503, and I got someone from 248, and you're all talking to each other, and I'm not privy to the conversation. What's going on? Help me out here.
Oh, you're mistaken. No. I'm not at either of those. I'm in Freedom Land. I have no number.
Okay, fantastic.
You are muted. no, the computer.
There was a lady. There was a lady that was speaking, and she had something to say. Are you done?
Oh no!
You done it now.
All right.
Again.
Well, okay. So I'm back. I muted myself because I thought that someone else was trying to talk.
Yeah, I went ahead and muted the second party because he was not giving you the ability and consideration to speak your mind, and I'll unmute him in just a minute. Go ahead, dear.
Okay. All right. Well, so thank you for inviting me to this call tonight. And one of the things that was on my mind is seeing a lot of the news events, you know, a lot of people, including me, trying to figure out what is, you know, really going on, and I'm seeing the banker situation is really essential, right? There's a banking element to everything that's going on. It seems like maybe as old as time. So when I see these different gurus, as you call them, that are out there and they're talking about anything having to do with, you know, banking, and I'm seeing some of the banking attempts where they want to move a group of people, what they, you know, all the different currencies, and I mean, you name it, right? You've heard someone just simple like Catherine Austin Fitz speak, perhaps, and I'm not trying to, you know, put her out there as like she knows everything or that I know her deeply or whatever, but, you know, all these people who kind of come out from the system or having worked in the system and they're trying to say, hey, this is what I'm seeing, this is where it's going, and so forth, okay? So I'm seeing these efforts to go in a certain direction to draw the people into, say, perhaps a new monetary system or a system of control or whatever. And I'm seeing how some of these gurus can actually be playing a role to actually help move the populations to where they want them to be. Is that making any sense?
It certainly does. It goes to motive.
Yeah, and so it's not necessarily genuine. But what I'm, you know, what I'm seeing is it's a, what if I want to call it a bait and switch, or if it's a, they call it sting operation, a way to capture people and capture their, say, credit, their value, their worth, a way to capture them into a certain position so that they can attach all of the things that come with that position and sink the ship.
You know, it's interesting you should say that. If I can comment, and not to stop you from speaking, but you mind if I sidebar off of that?
Go for it. I can even put myself on mute while you do.
No, you don't have to. You're doing just fine. But I just want to let you know I've been at this long enough to be part of the mentality of what appeared to be level-headed people that were warning us of digital currency and a cashless society and martial law. And I was amazed, dumbfounded, perhaps even bewildered that the very things that when I cut my teeth in understanding freedom, the things that we were opposed to 25, 30 years ago was being promoted by the gurus, taunted and put in front of our faces as, yeah, let's go. We need martial law. We need to correct these corruption and these government officials, and we want the martial law. I mean, I was surprised that the very things that we were standing against 30 years ago are being promoted by the gurus of the day. It just reminded me what you just said. I just wanted that sidebar. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, some of the opportunities that we've all had to perhaps interact with people who are looking into stuff like this, or, hey, I see a lot of people at least trying to figure out what's going on. And we are all beginning to face this issue of not being able to pay, in a sense, you know, like bills coming due. Like you see, the idea is to so-called foreclose, you know, on an entire nation. Right. So if anyone's been paying attention to what's been going on with, say, somebody in foreclosure the past 10 or 15 years and just be watching what's happening with assignments and titles and all of this kind of stuff, when courts would just allow any old thing to be assigned at any old time and say, yeah, that's fine. You know, like the new way to acquire property. You could see that there was groundwork going in to make it really easy to just take basically anything you wanted, just file a court case. And you mentioned, you know, earlier how many people could even defend, be like, whoa, that's, you know, I just want to challenge that assignment. I didn't assign my title over unless, oh, yeah, just another homeowner trying to get a free house, challenging an assignment. Yeah. right? So we see all this groundwork going in, and then we're seeing, like, you know, present time where a lot of people are facing financial ruin. So I see that there are, you know, people are like facing a wall, like, how do I pay? What do I do? So I see that there's an open door. That doesn't necessarily mean a good thing. It can be compromised. You know, if you get what I'm saying, like,
there's definitely a
vulnerability that people are in.
There's definitely a fraud going on.
Yes, there is.
There is a fraud going on, but it's a criminal fraud.
Yeah.
And it is an opening for a lot of gurus that do prey in that field, especially because of it. But that's the market, you know. It's up to each of us to do our own homework and listen, you know, and do the research. Because, again, fraud is fraud. It's a criminal thing. And fraud is not all that hard to prove, okay? But people are trying to go in there and use some you know, 30-year-old internet, you know, trash paper to use some commercial remedies that have been proven wrong over and over, and they're being repackaged and resold, and they still don't work. And people are getting in trouble because of it, and people get in trouble because they don't do their homework. Not because they followed a guru, okay? Because if you do your homework, you won't have to follow a guru. You'll be your own.
And it's not going to get any better. I'm going to suggest to you that when you have these government agents handing out money thousands at a time, here's free money, let me stimulate. What are they stimulating? They're stimulating the breakdown of our society. I suggest do your own homework. I'm not claiming that my word is gospel, but the way I see it, you start handing out money like candy, you're devaluing our society and the economy. A lot of you might be thinking, well, good, that thing needs to fall anyway. Well, that's a little bit ignorant, because that's going to affect a lot of people. There'll be a lot of starving babies. If you get your wish, we don't replace a failing system by looking for chaos and World War III. That's not the way that God's people think, at least not the ones that I'd like to associate with. So thank you for that comment.
You know,
and go ahead.
Catherine Austin Fitz said something that stands out to me. She said, you know, there is an effort by these powers that be, so to speak, right, that they want to crash the system by which you could actually be reimbursed. You see? This is one of her warnings that she said. She said, really, if there was a balancing of the scales, like you talked about just weights and measures, right, and actual honest accounting, let's bring all the books together. And this is one of the things that I think Jesus was doing when he came in the temple and when he was talking about equity and accounting and give to Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's, right? Let's balance this out. And even he laid down the greatest gift to balance the scales. You know,
that's not what that refers to.
Well, you know, there can be a lot, and I'm not saying that's the only thing that refers for whatever. I'm saying I was inspired.
No, that was about the render to Caesar was about allegiance, period. Has nothing to do about paying taxes or has anything to do with money. It's about allegiance. That's what that whole thing was about.
Right, but that's also an accounting principle. Who's the creditor? In any court case, who's the creditor? To whom do we give this money? Who's this debt owed to, right? Give it to them. That's who gets this car. You're going to repo the car? Who does it go to, right? Who's liable on this debt? Who should be paying? Give it to the one who's paid. That's, I'm just talking about that principle. Okay, and so we don't even have to point to
Jesus. The whole system is debt. It's a debt-based system. It's all debt. It's created out of nothing. It's literally accounting, you know, that's all it is an accounting. None of it is tangible. All these credits are not tangible. The car that you bought, you bought with a promissory note, whether it be a Federal Reserve note or your own private reserve note. You know, you used a promissory note, a debt note. It's all debt. So they're creating something out of nothing, expecting you to give something of substance back. It's a fraud.
Right,
it's
so
a
again,
shell
we just
game.
Right, and again, just accounting on all that. You know, an honest, accurate accounting. Because that will help see where the flow of funds is actually supposed to be going, who the actual creditor is. You know, I mean, we've been through this, right? You know, in foreclosure, defense, and all kinds of things. Right, so those concepts. But it was that Catherine Awesome Sitz was saying she was very concerned that if the system itself, like the financial system, was destroyed, that there was a lot of like evidence in that system for accounting purposes, like she talked about missing money and so on and so forth, that if you destroyed that whole system, you actually basically made the whole thing go dark, then nobody could pick up the pieces, and the apparatus for restoration, and I'm speaking to like what Daniel was saying about, you know, how many babies are going to go, you know, starving if the whole thing just implodes. There is a concern that if you just keep pumping that money out there and all those free checks and all this kind of stuff and, oh, crash it anyways, who cares? Well, that's actually not. Those are the books and records. That's the accounting system that can help us even, you know, talk about like in detective shows, figure out the crime, or figure out to whom this should have been paid to, or who was actually backing it all this time. What if we actually honestly discover that so many of the people that they're accounting for as debtors are actually the sureties that have been, you know, or, you know, the underlying creditors that this has all been built on the backs of?
Imagine that.
Yeah, and if we really want to do equity, you know, before we just have pity on the poor man and give him a bowl of soup, maybe we should be giving him an honest accounting and find out that he actually has money in his treasure to buy the bowl of soup. But
so, I do appreciate your comment.
You would need new guards over your assets. People have been putting their assets in the name of the state for a very long time, and those actors have been stealing it for as long as it's been there. So again, you know, managing your own affairs, there's a lot to be said for managing your own affairs. I mean, if you did a true accounting, you know, I would bet that you would find that a lot of the people have disappeared already. Just like they put in a factory, right? And the politicians all pushed for it. And, you know, factory goes up. Factory does their business. They make their millions. They pollute the streams and the land behind it with poisons that are coming out of the factory. And by the time anybody knows anything, they're all gone with the money and, you know, gone. They burn the building. They burn the paperwork. They burn the trail. This is what's going on in this economy, them pushing it to the brink and wanting it to collapse, because if it collapses, their fraud won't be found out. And they can claim us to fix it.
Right.
Thank you, David. They want to collapse the system. They want to purposely collapse it to start that universal income plan, and basically is have people be dependent on that, and that is basically to control the populations. That's a form of like communism, what's going on right now. And with the stimulus, and even with the stimulus package, not even the politicians have even read the stimulus package, which even includes a kill switch for your car. Most people didn't even catch that. But anyway, it goes way further than that. It's actually accepting any kind of government benefits. It's a covetous practice, violation of the 10th commandment, which goes way back. I mean, we can go back, clear back to when the Hebrews were under the Egyptian rule. They weren't there because they got captured. They contracted with the Egyptian government. They said, we can't take care of ourselves. And the Egyptian government said, well, what we'll do, we'll give you free housing, free food, free protection, but in exchange, you got to give us, every man and woman has to give us 20 tallies of bricks every day. Then the laws became more and more oppressive until finally God had to step in after 400 years of slavery and get them out. And then he said in Deuteronomy 17, never come back this way again. Then it became oppressive once again, because actually we are guaranteed under a republic form of government, but the term republic comes from the Latin idiom libera res publica, which means free from all things public. In other words, officials, government officials, were titular in name only, and a free man could either choose or deny whether to participate. And the problem is what you have now. And the bad thing is people contracting, and that's why even God said, create no covenants between them and their gods. The word God in any standard concordance means ruler, judge, and a deference to magistrate. So he's saying, stop contracting with these people. And because even Jesus had to step in, and he took the power away from the Pharisees and the Sadducees and says, I'm giving it to my little sheep, which was his disciples, which basically one of the first true republics was actually Israel when they came out of Egypt, where they ran their entire government on free will offerings and free assemblies. There was nothing that was being forced. Now, when they got Samuel to be the first king, he created a forced offering. And this is where it has been repeatedly stated throughout the scriptures, is in regards to where even David said and then Paul said later, do not eat from the king's table. It will be a snare to you. In other words, it will entrap you later. And it even says in Proverbs, if you eat from the king's dainties, it's better that you put a knife to your throat. And this is the problem, is this covetous practice that nobody is actually looking at. Just like Social Security, that's a covetous practice. It's been bankrupt from day one. It has been broke from day one. And it's enslaving people, because what's happening is when you have to, when you go to apply for your Social Security benefits, that has to be taken from your neighbor. They're not voluntarily contributing to that. That's being forced. That's covetousness. And this goes on with all these different government programs, is by receiving them. And that's the big problem, is that nobody is looking at that, is that you got to get away from contracting with the government. I mean, this is really, it's what's snaring you. Yeah.
I think, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you
go right ahead.
Me?
We got you.
That's where I am seeing with all this. I've done a lot of, you know, just real quick, this, I think this is very important. It's that initial snare. And what I'm seeing with these, I've been working with some people over this last couple of months. It's very amazing. The key is the condition of the, we'll call it the surety. There is no surety that is allowed to be non-pledged. In other words, you must have a God. And if you do not proclaim a God, one will be presumed for you. So it is the condition of the surety that is really at stake here. That's the linchpin. That's the key. And some of
But do you also really understand that even? Do you even understand that even the federal?
No, I'm sorry. I can't do that. If somebody's speaking, we have to let him finish. I don't know who that was that jumped in, but please finish, and I'll unmute him.
Okay, I'll try to be quick, because I mean, this is, I had to stand on the religious exemption, okay, to help, you know, save my family this year. It almost makes me cry, okay? It's always been my position, as I've been with my family for years, right? This isn't something new that I just cooked up in the back room because this shot became mandatory, so-called mandatory, right? Okay? So what I had to do is document where that surety, or where my placement of faith has been all these years, and I documented it, and I documented it right in God's Word, and I presented those documents to the employer, and I told them that the salvation, when they asked, what's the accommodation you seek, I said, full absolute salvation from your policy, right, pursuant to my religious observation, which is not negotiable, okay, and which is not underneath your jurisdiction so that you could make a determination as to whether it's in my favor or not. You see, it's not under their discretion. And I had to be very strong with them. So,
but it's a key word that you said was.
Go ahead and finish. I muted them accidentally. Go ahead.
I know. I'm trying to be fast. So what happened is they accepted, and then I wrote a receipt letter back. I'm in receipt of your acknowledgement, and yes, indeed, I just grabbed it from them, right? Like just absolutely. And you know, you had no choice but to acknowledge that. Thank you very much for doing so, and let it be to me and everything that is derived from me. And that's right, okay? So what I was observing in all of this is that this is key to not only the employment situation, but it was also key to all the health departments, all the so-called government entities, whatever any of them are. This is the key. What they're going after is, where have you placed that faith? Can we say that you are pledged to full faith and credit to fill in the blank, you know, the United States or whatever? Or is it actually the provision that's there for you to be in full pledge, full faith and trust to God, your creator?
Beautiful. So thank you for
it. Yeah, and I'll stop. So some more people can talk.
The big key that you were saying was jurisdiction, okay? Instead of asking for a religious exemption, you should be asking for a religious exclusion, just like with the difference where, if you look at the difference between when Jesus was before Pilate and as Paul was before King Agrippa. What Jesus said when Pilate says, don't you realize I have the authority to crucify you or set you free? He says, you don't have any authority over me unless you got your authority from God or heaven above. And right there, Pilate knew he didn't have any authority, so what did he do? He washed his hands and basically saying, I'm dismissing your case with prejudice. It's the same thing. If you look up and research jurisdiction in repeated court cases, it's citizenship that confers jurisdiction, not residence, inhabitry, or domicile. It's being a citizen, because if you go back even to the primary definition of the term Black Law Fifth, is one who submits himself to the dominion of government. Myself, I have a belief that when you become a born-again Christian, your citizenship changes, your allegiance changes, as does your domicile changes. That all changes. And it goes back to, what authority do you believe that you have over me? You can't say, just because I live here, you do. Because if you go clear back even to John Locke, Second Treatise of Civil Government, 1669, he said, before you enter a society, you got to do a declaration of consent. Well, I never did one. Secondly, also into citizenship, it would have also that the U.S. Supreme Court has said in Laurie of the U.S. and U.S. v. Polson, that citizenship is a membership into a political society. Citizenship is not a right. It's a government-granted privilege. That's Ex parte Fung Sing, 1925, and also V. Wilkins, same thing. It's a privilege. So if you want that, and even Blackstone said it came from the feudal system, which was a mutual relationship between the lord and his vassal. Vassal means slave, bondsman, or subservient. And it just carried over from the laws of England here to America, but you have to accept it. So what if you're not a citizen? Well, you don't have to be a citizen. You can be a people, that can be singular or collective, or you could even be a national of a state, and that's even in the Federal Statutes at Large, Volume 66, 101, A21, codified under Title 8, USC 1101, A21, and it's also in Am Juris as well. You could have a different type of title, because it's about jurisdiction is what they have over you. That's the whole key, is jurisdiction. Anytime you go into court, the first thing the other side always challenges is jurisdiction. If they don't have jurisdiction, they'll always challenge it, motion to dismiss. And normally that's the first bite at the apple that you take. So it's getting back into just like even what you were saying about your exemption, I would go for an exclusion, not even an exemption. And even the Supreme Court said in U.S. v. Seeger is that there's a higher loyalty than there is to this country, and that's a loyalty to God. And do you realize in Scripture, there's not one verse that says that you owe any loyalty to a country or a nation? Nothing.
Right.
Nothing. It says that, what did Jesus say? What did Jesus say? When the attorney asked him, he said, what's his greatest commandment? Jesus says, love God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and then love your neighbor as yourself. This will be followed by all the law and all the prophets. Well, your neighbor, if you look in, that's why I say a national of a state has the best resemblance to that, because in the Afron v. Russ case, 1967, it said that the state means the people and not to Congress. And that, but it talks about, even as a national state, it has permanent allegiance, even though the code is actually somewhat vague. It's a contingent permanent allegiance where God is a primary permanent allegiance. There's two different ones there. But it still goes back to that. And the perfect example is like when Jesus said, before he blessed the two fish and the five loaves, he commanded the people to do something. He said, sit down in groups of 50. What he was saying, form your own society, your own community, that you could help one another and not be dependent on government, because it will be a snare unto you. And what you mentioned also earlier in regard to call no man father, that premise came from in Jesus' time. Father was known as constricted patre. That's what they used to call the Roman senators, because the people used to go to them and beg them for benefits and privileges and different miscellaneous things. That's why he said, call no man father. You only have one in father, and he is in heaven. That's why he didn't want them to go and beg the government for any kind of benefits, because that is what would ensnare them. Okay, I submit.
You did pretty good there. You know, in the book of John, 3 John, we're told that they went forth receiving nothing of the Gentiles. So I am absolutely adore the fact that you perked on building our own societies. We've been talking about that on these calls for a couple of years now. And we're getting closer. We at least have an internet community. Some of you have decided to join each other in the geographical area. But thank you for bringing that to our attention, Darren.
Yeah, he also said that, remember where he said, do not be like the kings of the Gentiles, where their benefactors rule over them. This is not to be like you. You're not supposed to be a part of that. And that's the same thing when he says, you know, you can be of the world but not in the world. In other words, you can be in a society but just not a member of that society.
In the world but not of the world.
Right.
Yes. Thank you, Darren. Good conversation. That we're centering around the subject today was guru magnetism. What attracts us to these people that show up and they, like mushrooms, they fruit out of the disaster of the day. Like mushrooms, they appear today and they're gone tomorrow. What attracts us to these gurus? Any more comments? Any more discussion? Any questions? Floor is open.
Well, I have a comment, wondering, as I have been studying and doing these things to document where my faith is, I think that some provisions can begin to open up. When you've opened the door through your faith in God, right, the correct door, and you're talking about remember the benefits of the Lord, God wants to be your provider. God wants to be the benefactor, right? Call no man father. Call no other man that you're conscripted patre, right? I love that he brought that out. Our Father who art in heaven, he provides the bread. I think we can see some glorious provisions coming our way through that pathway, Jesus Christ being the path up to the Father, the gateway, the pathway. So I do believe that there's provision. And I've seen a couple things. I've heard some testimonies of people. It's very quiet. It's close to the heart. People who, some doors start to open up. So it's not that we don't want people to be provided for. Like when we see these gurus, or how else are people going to eat? How are you going to get what's coming to you and all this kind of stuff? It's so amazing, the concept of making sure where your faith is, where your heart is, because that's where your treasure will be. And God does intend to provide for those who call upon him. I think that there is provision there. So for those who are vulnerable, who yes, rightly are reaching out, who's going to pay for this? How am I going to feed my family? How am I going to this or that? Let's look at that condition of the surety. Are you a James Bond? Are you know, James 1:1? Are you bonded with Christ? Are you his bond servant? Is it on the record? Do you have that record of allegiance? Is the surety clear? Is the allegiance of the faith, the protection of the surety? That, I mean, I'm going to almost cry because that is what God seeks, isn't it? The jewels that he collects are, you know, to seek and save the lost, to bring those to himself. And there's provision there. And I think it's sad. I see a lot in the scripture where sad that he would look and see his people and that they would have any idea in their hearts that he didn't intend to provide for them, that they would have to go make a deal with the other in order for provision. So we, yeah, I hope you hear what I'm trying to say there.
I do. You're actually talking about exchanging a kingdom for a mess of porridge, mess of pottage, that whole story. I love it. And why would we want to give up where we are being protected and taken care of and nurtured and go to another where we're going to have to be enslaved in servitude? But you reminded me that I want to address a specific issue tonight. Okay, hold on. Whoever that was, hold on. You'll be next. I wanted to deal with something that the sister just shared, and I don't know who you are, and it doesn't sound like you've been on our call many times before, but welcome. Your comments and your encouragement is welcome and accepted, and we hope that you come back regularly on our House of Prayer call. So you are definitely appreciated. But what you reminded me of is I'm going to give you a guruism that many people have heard if you listen to a guru. This is a common phrase. All crimes are commercial. I've heard that through the last 30 years. I've heard that over and over and over again. Now, whereas I cannot tell you that in the criminal prosecution stage, there's obviously commerce going on. Well, we had to pay the clerk, and the prosecuting attorney gets paid, and the judge gets paid and sometimes has perks, and there's a commercial aspect of the criminal justice system, no doubt. The phrase, all crimes are commercial, is then supported, and the guru of the day will lead you to 27 CFR 7211. Now, that is a definition out of the Code of Federal Regulations in the 27th chapter, correlating with the 27 USC. And in 72.11 or 7211, you'll find that is a definition section, definitions of meaning of terms. And it has ATF officer, appraised value, carrier, and lo and behold, commercial crime is a term. Now, for those of you that have not been studying, term is different than a word. A term, you might be able to understand it as a word of art, words of art. They're specific words grouped together that have a specific meaning when they're grouped together. Now, commercial crimes is very specifically defined. And commercial crimes, if you read in 7211, I will show you how to read this law non-guru. Meaning of terms, commercial crimes. It doesn't say all crimes. It says any of the following types of crimes. And then it goes and lists those crimes which have a commercial nature to them, such as offenses against the revenue laws, burglary, counterfeiting, forgery, kidnapping, larceny, robbery, etc. It didn't say all crimes. It described commercial crimes. I'm just bringing that up as an example to help you understand that gurus are liable to say the Patriot nut job myth of the day. They're liable to be like a parrot, parroting what the guru 15 years before used to capture your attention, to make it sound like they know the law, but they don't read. And if they do read, they don't read explicitly and understand what they've read. They don't read the text. They've read it just to know that they've got a site to make the unobserving, uneducated sheeple that are going to listen to them follow their words. They're gonna you know, oh, he's reading from the Code of Federal Regulations. He's so smart. I'm so dumb. I don't know if anyone else has had that problem, but in my life, and I've been at this about 30 years, and I do, like I said in the beginning of this call, I do esteem others as better than myself, but sometimes that can be a snare because sometimes it catches me second-guessing what I've learned. And about 3 days later, I go, you know, I've been through this before, and I happen to meditate and remember that which God had brought me through, and I remember that I've already studied this out and found that it wasn't so. And what I'm telling you is that gurus have attracted me too. I have been that unsuspecting sheeple that have listened to the guru, thinking maybe there was something that he has that I missed. And I'm telling you, I haven't found any such guru in the past 30 years that I found to be 100% accurate. Now, I will tell you, and I won't lie, as I'm sure many of the men on this call tonight will agree, we've all learned something from somebody else. We didn't get it all ourselves. We didn't lock ourselves in the room and shut off the internet, or in my case, I go back to the age of the video cassette recordings. Oh, I got a good VCR tape you need to listen. We didn't even have DVDs back when I started. Oh, you want to go listen to some David Wynn Miller? Here's a VCR tape, and we put the VCR tape in. I'm going back to those days. But what I'm trying to tell you is I've learned a little bit here, a little bit there, some from Robert Fox, some from Billy Thornton, some from Carl Lentz. But one thing I have learned is it's not healthy to have a guru. Guru magnetism is a dangerous place to be. Anyway, that was my subject for the day. That's why I was redirecting that. There was somebody that I jumped in ahead of. I'm sorry about that. Go ahead and speak.
David, this is John. I got two little quick things to say.
Can you speak up, please? Can you get closer to your microphone? It's really low.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. 99% of the time, if you've got somebody that claims to be a guru and he's got some kind of super zoomy silver bullet for making the world go straight and all that kind of stuff, listen to his spiel. And at the very beginning of whatever he's got to say, there's going to be one particular thing that you have to take on a leap of faith. There'll be no proof. There'll be no evidence. There'll be no law. There might be some kind of twisted interpretation like Daniel was just talking about. There'll be something like that, and then he builds the entire process or whatever he's doing based on that single thing. And so when the foundation is lacking, the building will fall. It's as simple as that. You know, these guys that come in here and they make a statement and then they build a whole process on the statement that requires you to make some kind of leap of faith that what he's saying is correct. And that's where gurus get started, and they just take it, and people are always looking for something, and that's why they get these followers. Now, on the next subject.
I'm going to direct this to David. I'm sure he's going to have some fun with it. Most everything is considered to be, every situation is with the government especially, is considered to be some kind of trust. So I would like people to look up the definition of illusory trust. And basically what it is where somebody seizes the authority to act as a trustee when the conditions of the trust don't allow it. That's me paraphrasing it. Everybody can go read it and see what they think. But that's exactly what it is. A trust arrangement, which takes the form of a trust, but because of powers retained in the settlor, has no real substance and in reality is not a completed trust. So it's called an illusory trust. Anyway, that's my little take on the thing, and I yield.
What did you want to know about it?
Jump on it,
illusory,
buddy.
It's self-explanatory.
That's exactly.
It's illusory. It's an illusion. It's not a real trust. You have a grantor and the trustee and the beneficiary are all the same. It's not a true trust. And
courts a lot of times take that position.
Oh, absolutely. They can do that. They construct trusts in court all the time. Constructive trusts, and again, without jurisdiction, they're acting as trustee de sanctort, as basically a they're acting in tort against an act the trust action, or against you and your estate. Yes, they use a constructive trust in court almost every time. It's part of the, that's part of their process of getting joinder. And it's an assumed thing. It's another assumption or presumption that has to be rebutted before, before anything. Just like the rest of
illusionary trust.
Right. It's no trust at all. It's no trust at all. It has the features of a trust. Right, there is a grantor and a trustee and a beneficiary, but they're all it all resides in one person.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right. Let me comment on that because you really stirred me up with that one, John. Because we're dealing with that on a regular basis. Since a trust won't fail for lack of a trustee, if the court has your property, let's say it's your children, let's say it's let's just use children. If the parents don't know the indenture and haven't stepped up as trustee, and they're like Darren mentioned, they've got a citizenship relationship as a servant. We all know about the servant and master relationship, whose children those children are, from reading stories in the scriptures as well as history. These trusts are created in the absence of trustees. So one of the things that we spend our time doing, and John, I know you know this, is trying to help parents and people that we're working with become good trustees, understanding that what act did I do to give the court permission to operate this trust that you described. Instead of pointing the finger at them and saying they stole my child, point the finger at you and say, where did I give them the ability to create this trust? And then once we've done all that we've done, stand on it, and then you might cry persecution. But I warn us, I admonish us, before we cry foul, make sure that we didn't submit to the jurisdiction and grant it by certain acts or deeds to give over the trust property to be administrated by another. That's what it stirred me up to think about. Any comments on that, John?
No, I think you're right. I think, how we've developed our claim. Well, we're basically, when we develop that claim for the kids, we're claiming our property as a trustee. Now, we didn't particularly say that in the claim, but that's what it is. So when we claim the property, somebody has to come with a higher claim, and they have to declare themselves either a trustee or they have to have some property interest or something like that in the kiddos. And so far, nobody's come forward with any type of claim that's higher than ours, or any claim at all, actually.
And that's the quiet title action, and that's why declaratory action in that instance or for that purpose is a good idea. It's a good tool.
Some of you that may know that have been close to me, and I'll bring it out here right now, and I'm not at a place right now where I could say that we can speak this and share this with any great teaching ability, but we hope to soon, before the summer, be able to package up and give you folks some understanding where we've spent a lot of hours researching the writ of prohibition. And this is just a teaser because I don't have much to say about it. And for somebody on this call that is educated upon a writ of prohibition and has successfully used them in court, I will certainly quiet and stand down and quiet myself and press mute and listen to the voice of reason, logic, and experience. Okay, hearing none, that means that we're all in the same boat on this, unless someone was really shy. You can jump in and interrupt.
I have something to add on that, since you asked. It just came to my mind, okay? Sometimes when I see these kind of operations go into play like this, I put on my little detective hat and ask God to give me wisdom. Sometimes if you can see what's behind it. So sometimes what I perceive is there's a key position that they're trying to, that the system is trying to confuse you about or dissuade you about, to think it has no value. Right? For example, what if this whole issue of trust is so essentially important right now, and where you have placed it is an essential key? Will they allow something like some of these guru things to get going with this trust idea and this, you know, beneficiaries and trustees and social security system and all this kind of stuff going? So you're all into doing that to ad nauseum, to the point of ad nauseum, where then you don't want to hear about trust anymore, and all that trust crap, and blah, just throw that all, the whole baby out with the bathwater, right? So one of the things that I've watched is I pay attention for the pieces that say these gurus erase, the stuff they don't want you to talk about, like, oh, you just brought that, oh, don't talk about that. We're going to, you know, get rid of you if you talk about that anymore. Things like that, I go, oh, okay. After a while, I start to take note that, like, okay, don't talk about this, don't talk about this. This is censored, this is censored. Now what if I followed all those trails of those things? Ha! Light bulb goes on. Hey, that's a key piece, actually, right? So, see what you think of that.
Yeah, I sure appreciate that. It was sure relevant. I was on a frame, and I do appreciate that because it was going back a thought. I was sharing the writ of prohibition because I wanted the people to know at least that they can do the research along with us, and we can all learn together. This is a tool.
Right, and what I'm speaking to is that that's valid, and sometimes when we see the things misused somewhere, right, we get a bad taste in our mouth about that thing instead of, like, say, what you're going back to and saying, hey, but this does have value, and this is how we actually use it. Like, properly. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. If
yeah. Okay.
appreciate your zeal. Okay. Well, I can't.
Okay.
I'm not going to mute you out like I did for somebody else. So I'm just letting you know. I was trying to share with the group, and I thank you for your input, that a writ of prohibition, we have discovered some certain things about it, and forced to look into this tool. That
amongst my friends and people that I've been studying with, I checked ahead of time, and interestingly enough, nobody that I've spent time with learning and studying have successfully used a writ of prohibition except for one. And I didn't help him on it. Well, I did a little bit, but he did most of it on his own. And the interesting thing about that was he prevailed by using it. And the further interesting thing about that was when he was in the circuit court level, the judge said, well, if you don't like my decision, you can take it to the appellate court on a writ of prohibition, or mandamus is what the judge said. Well, it turns out, and I'm just going to leave this teaser for you, that a writ of prohibition is used not preventatively, but in the complete lack of jurisdiction of the lower court. And it's an original action where you're using the appellate court, whichever that would be. If you're in the district court, in some states, the appellate court would be the circuit. If you're in the circuit court, the appellate court in some states might be the circuit court of appeals. So you follow what I'm saying. It's the next court up, the appellate court, the one that has supervisory authority over that particular court for matters of appeal. But when you take it, you're not taking it to them on appeal. You're taking it to them as an original action. So these are just a teaser, some points for a teaser that we're looking into that seems to be very promising. Why would you want to spend the entire time of your life, your investment of energy in a court in the complete absence of jurisdiction, waiting to have the appellate court on appeal agree with you that there wasn't any jurisdiction, when you could learn the long and arduous and very stringent and rule-heavy process of writ of prohibition? And I meant the previous adjectives and definitions, as David will attest.
It is wasn't so bad.
Yeah, right. You're teasing, right?
Yeah. My head's still swollen.
Yeah. So the point is, though, that it wasn't easy, and it's sort of kept there, secreted away. And like I said, I've been at this a long time, and I only know one man, and he was forced to do the research and put his together, and he did prevail. But in 30 years, only having known one man that has, as a layman, not a lawyer, put a writ of prohibition into the court to get relief, that's a small percentage. But I'm sitting here telling you that this is the kind of things that I would encourage you to do, rather than practicing an unknown, untried, untested guru magnetism construct that has no basis in fact or law or reason. It's not just, it's not lovely, it's not a good report, and get yourself in trouble. Because you can find the writ of prohibition from the common law up and through into the rules, even in today in American jurisprudence. So that's what I was trying to say when I was bantering with you, the gal that was talking to me, and I don't know your name. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I think like part of what you're saying there with the writ of mandamus or the writ of prohibition also has to do with what we were speaking with about who you actually are, because embedded in that has to do with if they don't have jurisdiction and you're coming from outside of their jurisdiction, you see? But if you've made all kinds of, because I'm speaking also why this might not have worked for some people for so long, if they can uphold the presumption that you actually are under their jurisdiction and they're going to presume it, and then you try to go in with this writ of mandamus, already that key element of you being outside of them is missing, and that's where I know some people will get called in as in contempt of court, right, and be like, oh, it doesn't work. Oh, this guy's talking about, you know, writ of prohibition and all this kind of, it doesn't work. Well, that key piece, you see? I've also heard it described as a letter rogatory, that concept of coming from an outside jurisdiction. You can also even say, hey, we have a peace treaty between us. I come in peace. We are in two different jurisdictions, but that does not mean that I am coming in here at war with you. So that's kind of how it is.
Yeah, and Yeah, it was good. And just for the listening audience and the new people on there, there was a mixture of our conversations between public remedies and private remedies, and you need to do your diligence to understand them because we don't have the time on this call as we're nearing the 9 o'clock hour to go into that, the lesson in and of itself. But there are House of Prayer calls that are available on myhouseshallbecalled.com, 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 where you can go into the call recordings, the little tab on the right-hand side of the page, and listen to past call recordings where we talk about public and private different things and go into some great detail on some of those subjects. So we've got about, looks like, 25 more minutes before the 9 o'clock hour, which I turn into a pumpkin at. Is there any more comments, questions related to our subject matter today?
I
I'm
have
hoping.
A comment.
Hi, is that Linda?
I just want to say hello. I just want to say that, you know, I'm experimenting still with the Lord's Prayer, that prayer in Matthew chapter 6, verses 9 through 13, the Bible and Holy Scriptures. Prayer that starts with "Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, even in earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread." That's where we put down, that's where I'm experimenting now with places like Walmart and Fry's Food and Drug and Safeway. And I just put down the whole Lord's Prayer and send it in with a letter under "Give us this day our daily bread," giving us anything, whatever necessity we may have, and forgive us our debts as we also forgive our debtors, as being the payment that Heavenly Father offers them. I'm tired, and my words may not make a whole lot of sense, but I have given that prayer 3 times to the office of Walmart, and I have walked in and walked out 3 times with a grocery basket full of food. 3 separate times.
I might qualify that you walked out with a grocery bag full of food, but you never gave any money or so called.
I never gave any debt notes. And I have been looked at by workers and never involved, because I leave my groceries uncovered in the grocery bag. I mean, in the grocery cart.
We both know someone else that had practiced that and was also a gleaner, and using the gleaning passages like that, Linda. That's very interesting.
But I have sent mail to them stating that that's what I was doing, and sent a Lord's Prayer, that Matthew chapter 6, verses 9 through 13.
Well, keep us posted.
May I offer something about that?
Yes. You open conversation. Go right ahead.
Okay. In some of my prayers and searching these last couple months, I felt very strongly that God was showing me to use, this is just me, I'm just expressing my experience here, to use the Bible, the King James Version Bible that is recognized internationally, Public Law 97280,
yes.
He said that is my financial instrument. It is a trust indenture, and it is the bond, right? And you have drawing rights.
Yep.
So what do you do when you want to accept an instrument that is in your favor? He said to me, this instrument is also a charging instrument by which somebody can be condemned. And what matters is your position, your relationship. What are you in context of it, in relation to it? So do you have any documentation? What do you do when you find an instrument that is in your favor and you need to accept it? Say a banker's acceptance, right, I accept. How would you do that? So I did some things in my writing about how it would be that I would obtain a Bible, as I said, that matched with the 97-280, okay, public law, public domain, so it's a public domain, it's an offered instrument. It's an instrument, okay, an offer from God. I accepted it as an offer from my father. And yes. I accepted, and I put an endorsement in it. I accepted. And then moved forward in the concept that I then have drawing rights, and I'm commanded to do not forget the benefits of the Lord. And that whole list, you know, in Psalm, about, you know, all of the things, the provision that God would do for you, and that Lord's Prayer being so important, that daily yeah. bread, exactly as you're saying there, that really was true for me. So I started making these requests in all things through prayer, thanksgiving, prayer, make your requests made known unto God. So you're making your requests made known, but it is unto God, and they are part of that flow, you see. So your request is first and foremost the principle unto God.
Yes.
So I would suggest, that's why I say all this to you, to say I would suggest, because it's what I've done for myself, getting the Bible and accepting it, putting some statement right in it, you know, one of the front pages or whatever, that, you know, I yes. hereby accept. Okay, so that is like your instrument. Like, by what authority do you come in here and draw? How do you have drawing rights? How do you, and then that instrument that you have with that Lord's Prayer that, you know, is like you've used. And if you even wanted to document the things that you received by that, so you're keeping records, or just however God would lead you to do that. But I think that there is something to what you did there, because of what, you know, God has been showing me, and it's legitimate, and it shows too your faith was placed in God. So your faith is a substance, and you know how
yes.
God can multiply and provide from there.
Yes.
So you have made a deposit. You have made a good
yes.
faith deposit. And you have accepted a very powerful instrument. You see, you've accepted it. That's your relationship to it. And it's by that, your good faith in that,
yeah.
that you are drawing upon.
Exactly.
Hey, David. David, with that in mind, why don't you speak to how we're telling people to use such an indenture with our endorsement?
You're breaking up quite a bit, but I got.
I'm going to ask the question again.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was saying they're talking about putting an endorsement in the indenture. I said, David, would you like to speak about how we're encouraging people how to use that and how you can use such an endorsed instrument?
Oh, we use it in court all the time. That's how we're teaching, is to use that. Again, it's the Bible is an everlasting covenant, or that's another word for an irrevocable trust. And it is a trust. It is an indenture, the grantor, the creator of everything, has put down the rules for managing that trust relationship, and putting in a declaration of trust, like what you're explaining there, your profession of your trust in God and His Word is your bond. It is a bond. And it can be brought up in court through judicial, mandatory judicial notice in most states and in the federal. And again, you go down the line. They take judicial notice, if you look at the rules, they take judicial notice of quite a few things. One of them are public laws of the United States of America. 97-280 recognizes the Bible as God's word. And yes, we use it in court as well as the rest of our lives. But yeah, especially when we're dealing with the courts to establish our jurisdiction and our authority.
It becomes Exhibit A.
Yes, it does.
The indenture. Hey, I don't want to be a bad moderator and offend anybody, but Darren, I think I might have cut you off earlier. Are you in the middle of saying something?
I don't remember. I'm getting old.
All right.
I don't recall. I think it was a point of jurisdiction you were talking about. I think it was something related to jurisdiction. Oh, and also, too, if you look up the word freedom, it doesn't, in blacks, it does include self-determination, like the right of self-determination. You can say who you are or what your affiliation is. The court doesn't have the authority to do it. Just like the court doesn't have the authority to even declare what your domicile is, because that's a political question. They have no authority over that. But it's always the jurisdiction is always a paramount issue in any court. It's always something to be challenged. It's like you're talking about mandamus and prohibition. One is the gas pedal, the other one is the brake. It's just like a lot of the maxims. There are maxims that are like for the brakes and others for the gas pedal. They do different things. They have to know it. But there was also a very interesting case. If I could remember it, it was by the Florida Supreme Court. It was Wilkes v. I think Home Loan Company, where even they said in equity jurisdiction that the only thing the court goes by is the rules of court and the maxims. They don't go by anything else. I think that was like a 1935 case or so, something like that. But that was a very interesting case. Talk about that. But I yield.
Thank you for that, Darren. We got about 10 minutes left. Anybody would like to speak their heart and their mind and share? Hey, I don't mind stopping early, guys. I haven't eaten yet tonight, so I'm doing this for you all.
What was the name of that case that John mentioned first off the bat? It was something, LaFleur, was it Cleveland School Board? Was that it versus LaFleur?
John, did you hear the question?
It was a case that he mentioned right off the bat. I remember LaFleur, he wrote it down. It was under presumption.
We might have lost LaFleur. John.
It was LaFleur.
I don't remember
John,
the first part of it. I remember LaFleur, but I don't remember what he said at first. I thought he said Cleveland School Board, but I could have been mistaken.
It's Cleveland Board of Education.
It's who? I'm sorry, say again?
Cleveland Board of Education.
Okay, Cleveland Board of Education. Okay. There's also another case. It was in, I think, the Sixth Circuit. I think it was Murr v. The Internal Revenue Commissioner, I think it's M-E-I-R, which talked about that the law is based on presumption. Everything's based on presumption. There's even a presumption of citizenship, which is in Am Juris, which I found. It says until something is up to the contrary. And just like if many of you have ever read the Red Amendment by L.B. Bork, he was a big advocate of the state national. But the problem, what he was doing, he was sending out notices to all these different agencies. But according to the U.S. Supreme Court and Talbert v. Jansen, they said, no, that's not sufficient enough, which that case was based on these two gentlemen. They stole the schooner and they sailed it over to France. And then they got to France and they basically just filed a like a declaration signed by a notary saying, oh, now we're French citizens. The United States doesn't have any jurisdiction over us. And what the U.S. Supreme Court case came back and said, no, it has to be a judicial record. It can't be just be a regular public notice or a declaration or an affidavit. It has to be a part of a judicial record. So that's very important when you're doing your right of self-determination. I yield.
You did good. Thank you, Darren. And thank you for sharing tonight. Anybody else got something that they'd like to put on the record? We got about 10 minutes left.
I'd just like to comment on what Darren said. Is that can be in any case. It could be in a traffic case.
Correct.
If you have a declaration, go put it in there.
Correct. You're right. 100% right. In any case, as long as it becomes a judicial record, that's all that matters, because then you could always point to that and say, no, this is because if they tried to rebut that and go, oh, wait a minute, you got a birth certificate or under the 14th Amendment, no, that's a presumption. There's also something that somebody you might want to look at. There was under in YouTube, it was on the Johnny Carson show that I caught this, and they had the infamous criminal defense attorney Jake Ulrich, and he was asking Johnny, and he was always talking about, you know, records. And he goes, well, let me ask you a question, Johnny. He goes, what is your name? He goes, well, it's Johnny Carson. He goes, how do you know that to be your name? He goes, well, it's on a birth certificate. He goes, no, that's hearsay. He goes, but wait a minute, it's registered and everything. He goes, you don't have knowledge of that document. You only have knowledge of what you read to be. He says, but that's hearsay. That can be challenged. And you know what? He's 100% correct on that. So a birth certificate is a hearsay document.
That is a very interesting and enjoyable, entertaining clip, and I encourage you to look it up if you haven't. It's a short clip, and you could find what was the fellow's name again, the attorney?
Attorney Jake Ulrich.
Jake Ulrich on Johnny Carson's show.
Yeah, it was like 2 minutes in, but then probably the one that was even more significant was the Federal Judiciary Center back in 2001 on UCC 9 in bankruptcy, where they were talking, because I believe what the birth certificate creates is a registered unincorporated organization. Because this is what they were referring to, that you have to get the exact name, legal name of the registered organization to prove that it exists. So as this Laura Rush, she's a law professor at the School of the North, and she was talking to, at the time he was an attorney, but then he later became a federal judge in Nevada with
Bruce Martell.
And he said,
yep.
Yes, and he said it's referred to when the state issues a birth certificate. I said, that is very interesting. And that's why what I've always heard is that don't use that name that's on the birth certificate. Use another name. Remember, you can change your name at will, as long as it's not for an unjust intent or to an intent to defraud. That's under common law. There's numerous cases on that as well. So I just think, in my opinion, I believe that certificate, and I even have written evidence from a senior counsel in the Department of Vital Records in New York City that even told me that I don't own any of the records. I don't own the records. I don't own the original certificate. I don't own anything. I said, well, that's great. You put it in writing. That proves that there's no legal nexus between me and that certificate and that full name. And on the certificate, it uses the term full name. Well, when I was born, there was no such word as full name. And also, too, they listed my mother and father as being born in USA. That's all abbreviated. Problem is with that, you cannot be born in all the states. So that was an incorrect data entry. And also, if you look up your USA, there's over 66 synonyms and over 55 acronyms on that term. So the only way to actually know what that meant was be to cross-examine and depose the creator of that document, which I'm sure is probably dead by now.
Wow, you just stole my thunder there.
Thank you.
And I was going to further say that all of their documentation is not only fictional, but it's based on presumption, and you compound that presumption by accepting it. So it's like, really, nothing from nothing actually equals nothing. I'm getting feedback. Testing. Okay, it seemed to went away. It was actually juggling my thoughts. But the that name issue, that's why I don't claim a name. And there's some of you on this call now that know that I say I am called or I am known as Harold Ellis, because I've learned from a guy in Texas who is a very proficient at stopping cases with the name. Because without the acknowledgement and acceptance of the name, the court can't proceed. And so his position is, when they ask him his name, I don't have a name. But I'm called, and he'll give a name. And he said, and my wife also calls me an a-hole. I'm called this, but I don't own a name. And they get stuck.
Harold, that reminds me. I'm sorry, were you still speaking?
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, it's been a great call. We went from guru magnetism to a couple other subjects, but you reminded me of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That film production where the old blind man was on the train tracks, pushing the hand trolley down the road. They jumped on and got a ride with him on the train track. And they ask, what's your name? He responds, I have no name. I works for no man. Anyway.
Well, we got
anyway, if you haven't seen that scene.
I wanted to mention something also, too. The only thing that I did differently is I actually had a special name change just of the last name. In other words, it's totally different from what's on that registered document, but I did it through an ecclesiastical tribunal, which actually brings in the Watson v. Jones case, which basically says anytime an ecclesiastical jurisdiction renders a verdict, it's binding on all secular courts. And this way, it was actually created with a counter deed. A counter deed, and also a deed poll, but it's registered through the ecclesiastical tribunal. This way, that's perfected title. The title has not been split, and it's still held by the ecclesiastical tribunal, so the government doesn't have any claim to that name whatsoever.
Well, you can always create a private person name, and they have no jurisdiction. Whenever a name is introduced that is contrary or not part of their system, they have no jurisdiction over it. I've been using private person name for a while.
I was telling you all this in the past, that I had known a fellow that did this and was being prosecuted and facing 77 years incarceration for changing his name in the state of Missouri. And he did escape that. By the way, that's the writ of prohibition. And the appellate court agreed with him that he did not require a court action to change his name by common law rule.
Right.
Anyway, that puts us at the 9 o'clock hour, folks, tonight. And we've got another subject for another day, it looks like. Looks like we might have a name change or a name subject with the kind of guests that we've had on tonight. I know both Darren and Harold. And for those of you that minds might be spinning, about the subject of, do I call myself this name or should I accept the name? Should I use a different name? We'll actually have that conversation again, and we'll have a roundtable discussion where David, who uses his birth name, will talk about how he doesn't get trapped up in the name game, and Harold that does has a name change his way, and Darren does a name change his way. None of these are necessarily the right way or the wrong way as promoted by me. I'm not suggesting that I'm endorsing or condemning any of these three ways, but there are three different ways that three different men of God have chosen the name, and all three of them have found a level of success, and you can be the judge. So I'll say that we're going to put that topic as a hot topic in the near future if you guys are willing to play ball.
No problem.
Thank you.
How about you, Darren? Are you willing for that in the future, in the near future?
Of course.
All right. Well, that's going to be an up-and-coming. Next call is going to be on the, what is it again, it's going to be the 24th. We're going to have part two of Guru Magnetism. And I tell you what, if we don't have our guest speaker on the 10th thereafter, I'm just going to put it as a teaser. We may do our how to use a name on the 10th of March. Tentatively speaking, folks, it's been a great call. I hope that everybody that was wanting to say something got an occasion to speak. And we actually are stopping at the 9 o'clock hour as planned. I wish you all Godspeed on your way. And thank you for being part of the House of Prayer call. I'll see you again 2 weeks from now.
Peace be with you.
All right,
thanks. Peace to everybody.